And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin.
And we have a great show for you today. Obviously, still recording from the home studio, although I'm trying a new mic setup. I'm hoping this sounds a little better for everybody. And we're obviously going to catch up on our normal news and all of that. But my very special guest for my deep dive today is going to be Jen Miller Osborne. She is the Deputy Director of Threat Intelligence for Unit 42 at Palo Alto Networks. And that is a very long title. But the bottom line is she is one of the leaders of one of the most premier threat intelligence gathering outfits on the planet. If it is outbreaking in the world, Unit 42 is one of those ones that is catching it, finding it, reporting on it, and making sure we are all safe. So I am very happy that I was able to recently sit down and talk with her. And so I'm going to bring that interview to you guys in my deep dive segment. But as always, let's start with the news. And in 5G news, and we do have to talk about 5G once again, because conspiracy theories are still spreading like wildfire. And the question I'm asking in this news bit is, are we too late to fix this? Now, here's what's going on. And just as a quick recap, I've actually done videos on this. I don't know if you guys, anybody listening, watches my daily videos or listens to my daily podcast. I've also talked about this on the air here. And we have a problem with 5G conspiracy theories that started back, and they've been going on for a while, but they really exploded around January or so, thanks to Facebook groups that were being rather prolific with this. But this was mostly in Europe. The United Kingdom, the UK, saw a rash of burnings of cell phone, 5G specifically, cell phone towers, as did Western Europe. But now they're coming here to the United States. And according to a recent Department of Homeland Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, memo, here we go. In Tennessee, attackers have physically disabled electrical breakers at more than a dozen cell towers. In a separate incident this past April, according to this memo, white supremacists using the encrypted messaging platform Telegram basically used Telegram to encourage its people to outfit drones with explosives and fly them towards 5G tower sites. Now, the CISA released the advisory on the eve of a global protest, quote unquote, that was basically created by anti-5G activists. That was for a few weeks ago or so. Now, the conspiracy theories, fueled in part by people like Woody Harrelson, the celebrity of Cheers and, you know, a whole bunch of movie fame, basically risk hindering the deployment of 5G equipment across the United States, which is something that we really need. And this is something that the FCC's general counsel has warned about, in editorials and all of that, the last one being in the Washington Post. Now, by virtue of this, social media platforms, at least some of them anyway, are really starting to fight back against this. Twitter is getting very aggressive in labeling anything that links 5G to the coronavirus or cancer or, you know, any one of those things to basically pop open a label. So if I see your tweet and it says, you know, 5G causes, you know, coronavirus, I'm going to get a label from Twitter that basically says, learn the facts about 5G and we'll take you to an information page. Now, Facebook really isn't doing anything about this, but they are now starting to take a couple of steps in this by alerting users to basically government-owned media from outfits like Russia, Iran, China, and more. So if you're reading, let's say, state propaganda from Iran, here in the United States, and you don't realize that it's from Iran, Facebook is going to start labeling that. And so hopefully they will actually start stepping up on these just demonstrably proven false issues here. But the question is then, is it too little too late? You know, we have a society that basically has, I think, two schools of thought, you know, wedges and camps. Some of it is not necessarily on political lines. I've seen people both, that adhere to the left and right spectrum, of politics that have agreed that 5G actually does this because they believe the conspiracy theory more than they believe, you know, one thing or the other. Then, of course, there is the Bill Gates brain chip, that he is creating a vaccination to, you know, insert brain chips into all of us. And 5G is part of that control structure. So we shouldn't be spinning this up, you know, even though it's better bandwidth and all of that. So there's a lot of things that go into this, but as we divide up into these camps, as we have our multiple schools of thought, if you will, is it too little too late? Will we ever be able to get on the same page again? And I think that's something that we really need to discuss. And it's something that we really, I think, need to understand overall, you know, in the psyche, in the conscience, you know, of basically the American citizenry. God, I can't speak today. So by virtue of that, we can also see other countries that have really combated false information with an education program to train their citizens on how to spot fake news, how to critically think, how to look at multiple sources and basically confirm the veracity of what you're reading. Finland, Taiwan, you know, Germany, some other places that have been directly targeted by foreign state propaganda, like Finland had a huge Russia propaganda problem in the same way we did in the past election. Taiwan has a massive mainland China problem as well, as they have been targeting misinformation at Taiwan for years now, and it has been through these educational efforts of basically training the population on how to just critically think and be skeptical, you know, until confirmation, you know, of things like this. I think that is a very important thing. And so hopefully we'll get this straightened out, but that is your, I guess, 5G conspiracy theory news update of the week. And in legal tech news, did you know that now just turning your phone on constitutes a search? And that's actually a really good thing. Now, here's what's going on, and this is coming from Ars Technica, but typically, thanks to the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and all the case law built upon it and around it, police generally need a warrant to search your phone, and that includes just looking at the lock screen, and this is according to a recent ruling by a federal judge. But here's where it gets interesting. Usually when the topic of a phone search comes up in court, the question has to do with unlocking, and courts have previously held that law enforcement can compel you to use your body, such as force you to put a fingerprint, you know, on the sensor to open it, or basically put the phone up to your face to unlock it, but they cannot compel you to actually share knowledge, such as what is a PIN number? So for example, if you don't have a biometric like a fingerprint or a face, but you have to manually punch in the PIN, the police cannot actually force or coerce you to unlock that PIN. That is not allowed. However, in a recent case, the FBI did not unlock a phone. Instead, they only looked at the phone's lock screen for evidence, and here's what happened. Now, a man from Washington State was arrested in May of 2019 and was indicted on several charges relating to robbery and assault. The suspect, Joseph Sam, was using an unspecified Motorola smartphone. When he was arrested, basically according to him, one of the officers present hit the power button to bring up the phone's lock screen. Now, interestingly enough, the filing in court does not say that any officer present actually attempted to unlock the phone or coerce Mr. Sam into doing that at the time. And so this phone went into evidence, and in February of 2020, the FBI basically came out and turned the phone on and then took a photograph of the phone's lock screen, which displayed the name Streezy on it. And so Sam's lawyer then filed a motion arguing that this evidence should not have been sought without a warrant and therefore should be suppressed. And Judge John Coffner, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, Coffner of the U.S. District Court, basically agreed. In his ruling, the judge determined that the police looking at the phone at the time of the arrest and the FBI looking at it again after the fact are actually two separate issues. Now, the police are allowed to conduct searches without a search warrant under special circumstances, according to the judge, and looking at the phone's lock screen may have been permissible as, and I quote, it took place either incident to a lawful arrest or as part of the police's effort to inventory the personal effects of the person arrested, in this case, Mr. Sam. But because the judge was unable to determine how specifically the police acted, he actually ordered clarification to see if their search of the phone fell within those parameters, and that is pending. But where the police actions were unclear, the FBI's actions were apparently very crystal clear and counter to Mr. Sam's Fourth Amendment rights, and this is according to the judge. And to quote him, here, the FBI physically intruded on Mr. Sam's personal effect when the FBI powered on his phone to take a picture of the phone's lock screen. That qualifies as a search under the terms of the Fourth Amendment. And so, since the FBI did not have a warrant for that search, it was therefore unconstitutional. Now, the government, obviously, has their side of the argument, and they argued that Mr. Sam should have no expectation of privacy on his lock screen, because after all, that is basically what everybody sees. So by virtue of that, the lock screen then becomes public domain because this is something you are presenting to show the world. So let's say I were to pick up your phone and just tap it on, even if it had a passcode, I could still see who you got text messages or phone calls or news updates or whatever you choose to display on that lock screen. But the judge said that was irrelevant, stating, and I quote, "When the government gains evidence by physically intruding on a constitutionally protected area, as the FBI did here, it is unnecessary to consider whether the government also violated the defendant's reasonable expectations of privacy." So the FBI pushing the button on this phone to activate the lock screen qualified as a search, regardless of the lock screen's nature. Now, my own personal thoughts on this, I think this is a step in the right direction in terms of privacy. Personally, I honestly just keep my phone encrypted, and I also have my settings on my lock screen so that it does not display anything except the time, date, and charge level, which I think is a secure way to have that set up. So if I was in Mr. Sam's position, they could turn my lock screen on all they wanted, and the only thing they would see is date and time. So if Streezy, quote unquote, called me or texted me, whoever that is, in Mr. Sam's world, that would never show up on my lock screen. I would have to unlock my phone to see that. That's how I do it. And I think it's also a good idea to point out to basically everybody here that if you want to be super secure, at some point you need to ditch the fingerprints and the face IDs and just use a password, not a PIN, but an actual password, especially if you're currently protesting something like law enforcement. And obviously, we saw a lot of protests over the, just a horrific George Floyd incident and all of that. And so if you're out there protesting in all of this and possibly getting arrested by the police, getting rid of your fingerprint and your face ID and using a full-blown password to unlock your phone, while it may be temporarily cumbersome, actually secures you. And then as you are obviously adjusting your lock screen as well, making sure it doesn't display anything, and then your phone, one, they can't compel you to punch in a password for that, but two, they won't see anything coming in or out unless you unlock the phone for them. I think that's something to consider, and I think that's good for everybody else. I use a full password, although I typically use a biometric like a fingerprint. Although I use a tablet for work, and that tablet does not have any kind of biometrics. I have to punch the password into my tablet in order to get it in, and that is because that tablet to me is hyper secure. So take that for what it's worth, but I thought it was very interesting news, and so that is your legal news of the week. And in quick FCC news, I thought this was actually really interesting, and I don't have much on it at this point, as this story develops, but we should know that the FCC may actually be in trouble for faking support for anti-net neutrality. Now, you've heard me talk about net neutrality on the air here, and if you watch my daily videos and podcasts and all of that, I have definitely talked about net neutrality. But apparently, a federal judge has just ordered the FCC, as of a few weeks ago, to turn over server records to the New York Times, because their reporters have been looking for this, that might actually reveal that the IP addresses behind a lot of the comments that supported repealing net neutrality may actually be faked or might be part of a group, in other words, a pro-net neutrality, let's say political action group, or even from the FCC themselves. And so we are looking to get that information because the support that the FCC says that they had from the public may not actually be real, and they may not actually have that. And so as this story develops, I will give you more information on it, but this is something that might be huge, and we'll see where this goes. And so that is your FCC/net neutrality news of the week.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And in amusing news, and I think you guys are really going to dig this one because this is actually pretty funny, but this news article is about what happens when a major U.S. military branch loses its trademark to a TV show. And you may know where I'm going with this, but stick with me here because this is great. And it's actually coming from the Military Times. Now, you may know that the newest branch of the U.S. military is indeed the Space Force. This was announced a couple of years ago by President Trump. Space is apparently a war-fighting domain. And basically, if not now, then in the future, as we obviously expand out into space, which brings us to today. The recently launched Netflix comedy series Space Force is a satirical portrayal of the military's newest branch, starring starring Steve Carell, formerly of The Office fame, as well as The Daily Show and a whole bunch of other stuff. I'm sure you know who Steve Carell is. Now, Netflix, being proactive for their show, got out in front of the U.S. military in its claim to trademark Space Force for the show. And as it currently stands, Netflix has secured global trademark rights for Space Force in numerous regions around the globe, including Australia, Mexico, all over Europe, and also other places. And this is according to The Hollywood Reporter. Applications submitted by Netflix reportedly date back as far back as January of 2019. The only efforts, apparently, made by the Department of Defense, meanwhile, have come in the form of a trademark registration application with the intent to use in the United States, and that is pending currently with the Trademark Office. Realistically, the only area where this could become problematic is in the sale of memorabilia, apparel, and other items featuring the term Space Force. Even if the Defense Department were to get the trademark for Space Force, current U.S. law does not actually prevent the use of identical terms if employed as a parody, and that's what Space Force is. And so here's where it actually turns humorous, from humorous to interesting. Recent trademarks dispute that have been undertaken by the United States Armed Forces have centered on outside use of military symbols and imagery, in which case the Defense Department issues the following guidance. And to quote the U.S. Department of Defense, in accordance with subpart 2635.702 of Title V, Code of Federal Regulations, Department of Defense marks may not be licensed for use in a manner that creates a perception of Department of Defense endorsement or of any non-federal entity or its products and services. DoD marks may not be licensed for any purpose intended to promote ideological movements, socio-political change, religious beliefs, including non-belief, specific interpretations of morality, or legislative and statutory change. So in 2019, there apparently was a Christian jewelry company called Shields of Strength that was told by the U.S. Marine Corps to basically cease production of its Bible verse dog tags featuring an engraving of the Marines' logo, the eagle, globe, and anchor. And so basically, this is where we stand with this. As of this publication, the company, for example, this Christian jewelry company, has still actually selling this, but it's featuring the Army and the Air Force. What this tells us is that every branch of the U.S. military would then have to go after a company like Shields of Strength. But in this case, Space Force being Space Force, we may actually see the United States military, or that branch of the United States military, actually get into a legal battle with a Netflix comedy show over global naming rights. And I think that is rather interesting because, honestly, you gotta hand it to Netflix for getting out ahead of this. You would think that if you are basically going to be creating something like the Space Force, the very first thing you'd want to do is trademark the names. In the same way I run around, starting the trademark process when I spun up, my latest company. So I think that is very, very interesting, for them to do. So by virtue of that, that is your humorous military / trademark / Space Force / Steve Carell news of the week.
And now for breaches of the week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me, and I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin.
So the last few weeks for data breaches have been absolutely insane. And so we are going to do some of the big major data breaches of this week, just so I don't have to sit here for 2 hours talking to you when I only have like an hour. So here we go. But before we begin, I'd like to thank Jason Dance, Jacqueline Wolf, David Walker, Neville Goodles, and Barrett Peterson for sending me messages, tagging me, linking me, whatever that was to get me that information. It is always appreciated. Thank you so much. And if you have a tip for me, as I mentioned previously, please feel free to send it in. And with that, let's start with the first major one of the last couple of weeks, and that is BHIM, a mobile payments app out of India. They got hit for 7.26 million records when security researchers found out they were just leaving it exposed and basically insecure. And we are talking about the normal age, home address, birth, gender, et cetera, not to mention payment card details and all of that. So heads up if you use BHIM out of India. Moving back to the United States, we're going to talk about Aveanna Healthcare. They now have a class action filed against them. They're based out of Atlanta in the wake of their 2019 breach. They're a pediatric home care provider, and they have more than 166,000 individuals affected by this. And at the moment, on the wall of shame for the Department of Health and Human Services for 2020, they are currently the fifth largest data breach for HIPAA specifically of the year. I predict they will be further down that list by the end of the year. Moving on, let's head to Central Files, Inc. This is a secure record storage and distribution, storage and destruction supplier out of Indiana. And heads up to my folks listening in Indianapolis, this may actually affect you. It seems to be a bit north and affects a lot of things in South Bend, but you never know. And so what ended up happening was these guys were basically supposed to take and store these records or destroy the records depending on the order, and they were basically just dumping it into a location that somebody could literally just walk in and start picking up medical records. So if you have used St. Joseph Health System, Allied Physicians of Michiana, New Avenues, South Bend Medical Foundation, Goshen Emergency Physicians, Michiana Hematology Oncology, and Cardiology Associates, anywhere from, let's say, 1999 to about 2015 or so, and these are various years for all of these, heads up, you may want to contact them because you might be affected. Moving on, let's head on over to Spain, because they have an e-learning platform called 8Belts that basically was running on an insecure database in the cloud on Amazon, and it is estimated the private details of at least 100,000 e-learners, including national identity numbers, names, email addresses, contact information, etc., was exposed. So heads up if you use 8Belts. Moving on, let's head on over to Japan, because they have a cryptocurrency exchange called CoinCheck, and hackers actually took control of the account at a local domain registrar and hijacked one of its domain names or websites, and it basically was using that to then contact customers. And so that's a very serious issue. The attack took place on May 31st, and apparently CoinCheck has gotten this back and locked it down, and so hopefully no harm, no foul. But heads up to my listeners in Japan, and I do know that there are people in Japan that listen to this, at least on the SoundCloud version. Moving on, we're going to be talking about Digital Management Inc., or DMI. They are actually a major U.S. IT and cybersecurity provider with a ton of different government contracts, including NASA. Now, they just got hit with the doppelpayer ransomware, and basically that gang was at the exact same time they were congratulating SpaceX and NASA for their first human-operated rocket launch. They immediately announced that they had infected one of the networks for NASA that was being controlled by DMI. So according to the company's press releases, DMI's customer list includes several Fortune 100 companies and government agencies, and we now know that about over 2,500 servers and workstations in DMI's infrastructure were hit, which means they got in deep. So we're going to see, what that's going to be a mess for, or who that's going to be a mess for, not just DMI, but also NASA and some others, but that could be a very serious issue I might be reporting on for months. Moving on, we're going to be talking about West Tech International. They're a U.S. military missile contractor, so this is fun. They confirmed that they just got hit, and their computers were encrypted as well. Now, the attackers have already begun leaking files that suggest they had access to sensitive data, including payroll and emails, and they obviously copied in all of this out before they encrypted it, because they've been putting it online as proof that they hit this organization. Unauthorized access to data about intercontinental ballistic nuclear missiles would be bad enough, but depending on what the attackers access, they could actually have created more serious repercussions given West Tech's client list. So above and beyond DMI, West Tech includes U.S. military branches, government infrastructure agencies, major military contractors, including the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, the Joint Service Agencies, the Commerce Department, the Energy Department, the General Services Administration, Booz Allen Hamilton, if you recall, that's who Edward Snowden worked for as an NSA contractor, General Dynamics Information Technology, Lockheed Martin Information Technology, and more. This is another massive, insane breach I'm probably going to be reporting on for months if we see these companies hit. This is being claimed responsible by the Maze ransomware group, competitor to the DoppelPayer gang. So here we are. Moving on, let's talk about another IT services giant, Conduent. They admitted a ransomware attack hit their European operations, but says that it managed to restore most of their systems within 8 hours. Now, they were hit on Friday, May 29th. The company did not name the ransom type or intrusion vector, but the Maze ransomware group of West Tech fame has posted stolen Conduent data, including apparent customer audits, to its dark web page. So I'm wondering if West Tech and Conduent have something to do with each other. Moving on, let's talk about a math-solving website, Mathway, which isn't nearly as damaging as having a military contractor hit. But nevertheless, if you use Mathway, heads up. In January 2020, the math-solving website suffered a data breach that exposed over 25 million records. The data was subsequently sold on the dark web, and this included names, Google and Facebook IDs, email addresses, and hopefully encrypted passwords. So heads up, if you use Mathway or your kids do. Moving on, let's head up to the Great White North and talk about Fitness Depot out of Canada. They announced to their customers that their personal and financial information was stolen following a breach that affected the company's e-commerce platform last month. Apparently, the MageCart group is claiming responsibility for this, and this breach goes back as far as February 18th of 2020. Customers' names, email addresses, regular addresses, phone numbers, and credit card information was hit. Now, Fitness Depot blames its internet service provider for this, interestingly enough, saying, and I quote, "Based on our preliminary findings, it appears that our internet service provider neglected to activate the antivirus software on our account." Now, I find this interesting because I think this is the first time in history that I have seen a data breach basically having the finger pointed to the internet service provider, not the technology for defense that the company was running, because the company is now saying that their internet service provider was supposed to give them antivirus, and they never did. And apparently nobody double-checked this at Fitness Depot.
And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.